got a spring.
Welcome to another edition of Hey Doc. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, Medical Director of Southside Medical Center, right here in Jacksonville, Florida. I'm your host for the next half hour. With me today is my co-host and wife, Carmen Lasky, a certified EMT. Together, we hope that you will find the show informative, educational, as well as entertaining. As we promised on last week's show, Carmen and I are going to resume the lectures from the Pain Weekend Conference, an 8-hour meeting on the current state of pain treatment. Now, the titles of the lectures are often comical, but nevertheless touch on serious topics in pain treatment, from the mundane to the newest treatment procedures in medicines.
The topics include pain pathways made simple, relax, all antispasmodics are the same, right? Osteoarthritis pain, past, present, and future. Ketamine, not just for horses. Unraveling the secrets of imaging studies. And finally, evaluating treatment options for diabetic peripheral neuropathic pain.
Today's review will not be in chronological order of lectures, but more or less just gleaning out important information which we feel might be of importance and interest to you, our listeners.
Across the board, the general consensus of lecturers is that apart from treating the chronic pain as well as any acute pain adequately and safely, an attempt must be made to understand the cause of the patient's particular pain if we wish to use the most appropriate pain modification treatment.
This is not always the easiest thing to do, as we're often hampered by the cost of medicines and procedures to the patient and the insurer's failure to approve coverage for the same. The lectures on pain pathways really show the marvel of the body and its failures when pain becomes a liability. Remember that most pain that we experience is for our benefit.
For example, the automatic withdrawal of your hand from a hot surface protects you from increased burn damage.
Or the acute pain in the sole of your foot after stepping on a sharp object, such as a nail, again, preventing us from stepping down on it again and causing further foot damage.
Remember that pain is bidirectional. First, there is a painful stimulus, such as the nail penetrating the skin. This sends a signal from the foot through nerves that go to other nerves in the spinal cord, leading to other nerves that connect to brain areas where the pain is recognized and where a new signal is sent back down to areas around the body, such as the muscles in the legs that move so that we do not step back down on the injured area.
These nerves transmit their signals from nerve to nerve, not through direct contact as in an electric circuit that turns a light bulb on and off, but through the use of chemicals excreted by one nerve that in turn excite a new nerve signal that continues traveling, each time exciting other nerves or parts of the brain using chemicals that are secreted and excite.
It is at these areas of chemical change, apart from areas in the brain itself, that most of the medications and procedures that are used to alleviate pain will have their greatest effect.
For example, if we have a medication or a procedure that prevents the first nerve from secreting excitatory chemicals or the second nerve from getting stimulated to send a signal, then the pain signal can be stopped or weakened. Of course, many medications actually work in the brain to modify the signal that it receives or imparts to get the same result. Generally, physicians talk about four types of pain, called nociceptive, inflammatory, neuropathic, and functional pain. Nociceptive pain is from the noxious stimuli, such as heat or cold, or even mechanical force or chemical irritants.
Inflammatory pain, on the other hand, is caused by the inflammation or swelling in itself. Mast cells and white blood cells are involved with tissue damage here.
Neuropathic pain simply means pain that involves the nerves themselves, such as in diabetics who suffer from peripheral neuropathy secondary to their diabetic condition. And finally, functional pain, which is neither neuropathic or inflammatory in nature. We can also call this dysfunctional pain. I'm going to give you some additional examples of nociceptive pain, these being arthritis, mechanical low back pain, post-operative pain, sickle cell crisis, and even sports or exercise injuries.
As far as neuropathic pain is concerned, we have already stated that diabetes is one source, but so is HIV, as well as post-herpetic neuralgia due to the shingles, and even neuropathic low back pain.
So as you see, low back pain can really have two different causes. Most likely different treatments will be needed depending on the cause. It's interesting to note that pain is conducted through both excitatory and inhibitory transmitter chemicals.
The excitatory transmitters include substance P, calcitonin, peptide, aspartate, and glutamine, while the inhibitory chemical transmitters are GABA, glycine, somatostatin, and something called alpha-2 agonist.
One of the big questions in pain management research is how does acute pain become chronic? This is really important, since much of the chronic pain stems from acute pain, such as stepping on a nail or post-surgical pain. We naturally expect pain after an injury or surgery for a short period of time, maybe up to 6 weeks or so post-trauma. But when the initial damage is repaired, when healing has been completed, we expect the pain to go away.
But what happens to the patient when the pain does not go away and in fact may last for months, years, or lifetime, even when healing should naturally have occurred and the pain dissipated?
I'm sure that at some time you've given a handshake or touched someone's skin. Normally all they feel is the pressure of the touch, and that's it. But what if that simple touch elicits a painful response? This is then called allodynia. In contrast, hyperalgesia occurs when a slightly painful stimulus elicits an unexpectedly severe pain, such as when you scratch yourself minimally with a fingernail or get a small paper cut that leaves you howling in agonizing pain. Again, this is hyperalgesia. Of course, it does not have to be as severe as my example. Just have a lowered threshold to different types of noxious stimuli.
There are so many chemicals involved in the transmission of nerve signals that we would have a hard time naming them here before you got born. But to name a few, we have ATP, ASIC, EP, TRKA, PLC, PGE2, NGF, and a whole bunch of other chemicals that can be involved.
The World Health Organization, or WHO, provides a cute little slide showing three steps in pain treatment, the first being the non-opioids, such as acetaminophen or Tylenol, NSAIDs like aspirin, Naproxen or Motrin, and the COX-2 inhibitors, another type of NSAID, and this includes Celebrex. If pain persists beyond the use of the medications that I just described, then the WHO recommends the opioids, starting with the least potent and going to the more potent for more severe cases, such as in cancer patients. The VA has its own approach with four steps. It starts with no medicinal treatment, but includes such things as nutrition and weight management, exercise and sleep control, as well as mindfulness and other relaxation techniques, along with family and social support. When this is not sufficient, the VA recommends stepping the treatment up a notch to include further assessment of the pain, with increasing multidisciplinary pain specialty teams called into play.
At some point, most treatment plans may include medications, again starting with Tylenol and the NSAIDs, but later including such medication as anti-epileptic medications, topical medications, muscle relaxants, and finally, opioids.
Of course, there are FDA warnings about each of these groups of medicines. For example, the FDA warns about potential severe liver damage with the use of acetaminophen brand name Tylenol. There's also the possibility of something called Stevens-Johnson syndrome and toxic epidermal necrolysis. the NSAIDs have their own problems, including the risk of peptic ulcers. From the first day of use, all NSAIDs increase the risk of GI, that's gastrointestinal bleeding, myocardial infarction, and stroke.
All NSAIDs increase both bleeding and cardiovascular disease risk, but selective COX-2 inhibitors are more likely to cause cardiovascular events, whereas less selective NSAIDs are more likely to cause GI bleeds.
The risk of bleeding and of cardiovascular events is considerably higher in older people. Not only that, the NSAIDs affect the cardiovascular, GI, renal, and the respiratory systems as well. They increase systolic blood pressure by 5 millimeters of mercury and increase fluid retention in the body. All NSAIDs double the risk of hospitalization due to heart failure. And NSAID use in patients age 65 or older, they more than double the risk of acute kidney injury in the next 30 days.
They can precipitate bronchospasms, and 5 to 10% of adult patients with asthma will have an acute deterioration in symptoms after taking NSAIDs.
Bleeding is the better known consequence with all types of NSAID use. Again, older people have a higher baseline risk of cardiovascular events, GI bleeds, and impaired renal function, all of which are further increased by NSAIDs.
Remember, the cell medication of these by patients is also extensive. So if you are taking any of these, tell your physician about their use before he or she makes any medication recommendations.
To be complete, let's mention the more common opioids. These include codeine, fentanyl, hydromorphone, meperidine, methadone, morphine, oxycodone, oxymorphone, and tramadol. I gave you that as an alphabetic list, not related at all to the potency of the opioids. They are some of the most potent of the pain medications, but they too have their problems. Opioids can cause some side effects such as drowsiness, mental fog, nausea, and constipation. And they may also lead to slowed breathing, which can lead to deaths. Overdose could be a risk as well.
Other risks of using prescription opioids include dependence and addiction.
For those of you who are a bit hazy about the difference between dependence and addiction, Carmen is going to help you with that.
Dependence means feeling withdrawal symptoms when not taking the drug. On the other hand, addiction is a chronic brain disease that causes a person to compulsively seek out drugs even though they cause harm.
Drug abuse ranges from a patient taking too much medicine, taking someone else's medicine, taking the medicine to get high, or just taking it in a different way than it was prescribed.
This is a great time to tell you about Southside Medical Center. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, and I've been the medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center for the past 29 years. We're located at 3604 Southside Boulevard, just two blocks south of the Beach Boulevard intersection between the Pottsburg Post Office and the Tulsa Welding School. We will treat your pains, sprains, and strains. Our practice emphasizes chronic pain management as well as anti-aging medicine. We also have an office-based substance treatment program for those who need it. Southside Medical Center is open 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. If you would like to make an appointment or ask any questions about Southside Medical Center, please call us at 641-4411. That's 641-4411. Southside Medical Center, where your health is our primary care. Welcome back to the Hey Doc Show.
In the first part of the show, Dr. Lasky and I have tried to present the most salient information that we found while participating in the Pain Weekend 2019 conference here in Jacksonville.
The conference also touched on a common disease, arthritis, osteoarthritis to be specific. It may simply arise due to a general wear and tear, or it could have a more specific cause, such as trauma and injury. In osteoarthritis, there is cartilage loss in the joints with resulting bone exposure. The older you are, the more chance that you too will suffer from some degree of arthritis. As a matter of fact, 50 million Americans suffer arthritis right now.
Somewhere around 50% of the time, osteoarthritis is influenced by genetics, more so in women. And body weight, suppose that you weigh 200 pounds. Then there are 500 pounds of force on the hips and 800 pounds of force on each of the knee joints.
Repetitive loading and trauma, as well as muscle weakness, can also lead to osteoarthritis. Obesity, well, I guess you know how that can lead to arthritis. Apart from the signs and symptoms of arthritis, your doctor can often diagnose osteoarthritis using plain old x-rays. So apart from medications, what can you do to treat those pains that are due to osteoarthritis? You could go to any supermarket or pharmacy and look at the labels of the over-the-counter medications. You'll very often see bottles that contain glucosamine and chondroitin.
The speaker in our conference had positive things to say about this taken orally. He did mention that it takes about 2 months to feel the effects, and side effects are minimal, but include GI upset. You may not want to take this if you have any shellfish allergy.
We then have chondroitin sulfate, where a study showed that 800 milligrams daily of chondroitin sulfate was just as effective as celecoxib, better known as Celebrex, which we mentioned before, for lessening the symptoms of osteoarthritis. There are lots of other therapies used, including creams, NSAIDs, physical therapy, intra-articular injections, and, of course, weight management. The speaker then talked about some newer treatments, such as viscosupplementation, where a more viscous material is injected into the area of the joint. Now, these include products with names such as Suparts, Hyalgan, Gelsyn 3, and Duralane, just to name a few. The question still remains, is there a future in the newer research? A physician, Nancy Lane, MD, said that the need to find new drugs to treat osteoarthritis is simply critical. She went on to say that we really do not have anything that slows its course, and most people with severe disease end up on narcotic analgesics while waiting to have a joint replaced.
We said that osteoarthritis affects a large part of our population, especially the elderly. Well, another common disease, diabetes, is associated with a large number of sufferers who have peripheral neuropathic pain.
It's actually almost 50% of the diabetics who will, at some time in the course of their disease, have neuropathy. Think back to what we said in the beginning of today's show. Neuropathic pain is the pain caused by a lesion or disease of the somatosensory system and often presents with pain in areas where there is sensory loss, spontaneous pain, and evoked pain. What does this mean? Well, it means hyperalgesia and allodynia, two other signs that we defined earlier. So how is DPN, or diabetic peripheral neuropathy, treated?
The first step has always been to optimize control of the glucose levels, that is, the sugar levels in the blood of the diabetic, even though there is a lack of evidence that this lessens the DPN.
Nevertheless, this is where the other medical algorithms start. Of course, we need to diagnose it. Symptoms include burning, stabbing, tingling, numbness, sensation of hot, cold, or itching. In fact, this is often called the glove stocking distribution on the body, and this pain often worsens at night.
It has been suggested that medicines such as the antidepressants, anticonvulsants be used, or even the corticosteroids, local anesthetics, muscle relaxants as well, as neuroleptics and NMDA antagonists might be useful as well.
You may not be familiar with all of these categories, but you will be in a moment. Many drugs that have once been mainstays have now been deemed simply not effective, so we won't deal with those. Four that have been confirmed recently to be effective are duloxetine, venlafaxine, pregabalin, and tramadol. Also, several of the tricyclic antidepressants. You may think that it's curious that antidepressants will work in the case of DPN. Well, their analgesic activity relates to their ability to block the reuptake of two chemicals, serotonin and norepinephrine, which both happen to be involved in modulating spinal pain pathways.
So in the case of DPN, the pain relief is not dependent on the antidepressant activity of this group of medications.
The tricyclic antidepressants include such drugs as amitriptyline and imipramine, while the SSRIs include fluoxetine, paroxetine, and citalopram. I've already mentioned the antidepressants in the group of the SNRIs, which are duloxetine and venlafaxine. One of the most commonly used medicines of DPN has been gabapentin or Neurontin. Another similar drug is pregabalin, brand name Lyrica, that is on the list of recommended drugs in the treatment of DPN. But in the end, the final recommendations include the medications pregabalin, duloxetine, venlafaxine, and the TCAs such as amitriptyline.
Of course, a lot more was presented during the 8 hours that we were at the conference. But we only have a half an hour show, so Dr. Lasky and I tried to give you an information-packed resume as best we could.
But there are other things in the healthcare world that have come to light in the past week, and we really would like to present those before the whole half hour is up. According to Dr. Ativ Mehrotra, a Harvard researcher, the management of chronic illnesses, like diabetes, has become a big source of healthcare spending. Many in the healthcare professions are simply cautious. For example, many patients fear that the healthcare given at these drugstore centers might not be passed along to their own physicians. They also worry that the care won't become similar to VA, where many veterans complain that they never see the same physician twice.
For many, and not just children, a visit to the doctor is a stressful experience, as many still wish to avoid the pain of a needle being stuck into a vein to get a blood sample.
Although blood contains a wealth of potential biomarkers of disease, it can be challenging to obtain and analyze. Now researchers have developed a skin patch containing tiny needles that painlessly collect interstitial fluid for on-patch diagnostic testing. And the key word here is painlessly.
Interstitial fluid, or ISF, is the colorless liquid that fills spaces between cells in the body. This fluid contains some of the same biomarkers found in blood, as well as some not found in the blood.
Interestingly, ICF lacks the cells and clotting agents that complicate blood analysis. The fluid collected by the tiny needles goes through a multi-step process of biomarker extraction, centrifugation, sample loading, and analysis to detect these biomarkers. Now, the ICF collected by the skin patch can be analyzed directly with something called surface-enhanced Raman scattering, also called SERS. This is a technique that can detect and quantify molecules by looking at how nanomaterials scatter light.
The patch not only contains 9 very small and thin needles, but also a strip of what is called plasmonic paper that contains gold nanorods coated with a polymer that attracts a positively charged dye. Next week, we are going to review a really interesting discovery related to patches and diabetes. So please, don't forget to listen to our show every Saturday from 5:30 to 6 p.m. right here on WBOB Radio, AM 600 and FM 101.1.
I'd like you, our listeners, to know that I am one of several physicians right here in the Jacksonville area that has received the certification to recommend medical marijuana to those patients with certain diagnoses. These now include amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, cancer, Crohn's disease, epilepsy, glaucoma, HIV/AIDS, seizure disorders, chronic muscle spasms, multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's disease, PTSD, any terminal condition, as well as other ailments and conditions, including certain diseases with chronic or long-term pain. For more information, you can call our office at 641-44-44. We have also set up a special website at maridocs.com. That's maridocs.com, where you can get a lot more information on medical marijuana. You can also set up an appointment at Southside Medical Center right on the website. Again, that's maridocs.com. We've come to the end of another Hey Doc show. Carmen and I hope you've enjoyed the past half hour and found it interesting, educational, and maybe just a little bit entertaining.
So, from all of us here at Southside Medical Center, have a happy and healthy weekend. Goodbye.